Chapter 3. "We never had any intention of keeping it from you," said Dr. Stone. "Even if we had, a moment's thought would tell you that it would have been impossible. You're a public figure, Steele. What happened when you fought Stalker was given wide coverage in the media. They knew about your daughter's involvement, and they knew how she died, caught in the crossfire of the battle. Aside from that, you have friends, your fellow officers on the strike force, many of whom have known you and your family for years. There's no way we would have kept it a secret from you, even if we'd wanted to."
"Then why, for God's sake?" asked Steele.
"You were severely traumatized," she said. "Your daughter was killed before your very eyes, and Stalker had once been your partner and close friend, Officer McTaylor. Aside from the extensive physical damage you sustained in your fight with him, there was profound emotional damage as well, and you were experiencing other problems that you had tried to keep from us. I'm referring to the fact that the ancillary engram data used to supplement your matrix had started to express itself through your subconscious. You were having dreams about past lives and experiences that you could not account for. We call them fragments of ghost personalities. You should have told us about it immediately, yet you kept it to yourself."
"How did you know?"
asked Steele. "We have Dr. Cooper to thank for that. Exactly how we found out about it is immaterial at the moment, but the important fact is that you were in trouble and you didn't tell us. You were afraid we put you on downtime to debug your engram matrix, and you thought that when you came out of it again, you might not be the same."
"Yeah,"
said Steele, slowly, still trying to figure out how they could have known. And he knew that Raven never would have told them, and he'd been sure that there were no bugs in his apartment, but apparently he had been wrong. How else could they have known? "Do you feel any difference?"
"There's a lot I can't remember. It's like I've got amnesia."
"But do you feel any different? Do you feel changed in any way?"
"Jesus, how the hell would I know?"
"I'll show you," she said. "Who's Jake Hardesty?"
"Chief of the Strike Force."
"Liam Casey?"
"Father Casey, my old friend, the priest from St. Vincent's."
"You have a 45 Colt semi-automatic. What special significance does it have?"
"It was my father's." "Jesus, I do remember."
"Of course you do," she said. "We didn't remove all your memories. We only removed certain specific ones. Now tell me about your ex-wife. What was she like?" He shook his head, mystified.
"I have no idea. I know she was a blonde, but..."
"Tell me about your daughter, Corey."
"She's dead."
"Yes, you know that now, but what was she like?" He stared at her. "How old was she?" Steele moistened his lips. He was drawing a complete blank.
"What color eyes?"
"Stop it!" Raven shouted. "Jesus fucking Christ! What are you trying to do to him?" "I'm trying to prove a point, Miss Scarpetti. I'd hope to do this another way, but I'm afraid you forced the issue." She looked at Steele. "While you were down for repairs and upgrading, we accessed your engram matrix and ran a program to isolate all memories you had of Stalker or McTaylor, your ex-wife, your son, and your daughter. Then we ran a download to pull these specific engrams. Nothing else. You're still essentially the same man and you always were, only you don't remember being married and you have no memories of your family. Now the point is that we can give you back these memories at any time. All it requires is a loading procedure. The reason why we did it in the first place is that you were severely traumatized by the death of your daughter and your final encounter with Stalker. You were also severely damaged physically. It required extensive reconstruction. We wanted to make sure that you were fully functional, and we didn't want your recuperation complicated by emotional trauma, so we removed the sources of that trauma."
"Just like that," said Steele. "You simply wiped out 20 years of my life, just like that."
"Not all 20 years," she said. "Just certain segments of it. That explains those gaps you have. We wanted to prove to you that we could make changes in your engram matrix without causing any significant changes in your personality or loss of identity. We didn't try to keep any of it secret. Miss Scarpetti was fully briefed about it, and I was under the impression that she understood. She was given special clearance to visit you here on the condition that she would follow procedure and give us her full cooperation. Under the circumstances, it will now be necessary to revoke her clearance. However, as a result of recent developments, the point is really moot in any case."
"What do you mean?"
asked Steele. "Well, as you may well know now, the project has been scrubbed. The committee has decided to cut our funding. We don't yet know for sure, but at this point, it seems probable that the download project will be transferred to Los Alamos. The agency will no longer have control of it. In fact, there may not even be an agency after this. Higgins seemed to think that Senator Carman will take advantage of this opportunity to disband the CIA. If that happens, most of the agency personnel will probably be transferred to the military base or to other existing departments."
"What about me?"
asked Steele. "I can't really answer that," she said. "At this point, I simply don't know. Higgins seemed to think that they'll just cut you loose and you'll be free to go back to Strikeforce. However, they might have other plans for you. Right now, we just don't know.
I see, said Steele. Well, that's not the worst news I've ever heard.
You realize that once the project is officially shut down, unless they make some sort of separate determination in your case, you'll be completely on your own. You won't have any more support. If you experience any problems after that, we won't be here to help you.
I managed just fine before you people came along and turned my whole life upside down, said Steele. I never asked for this, and I never expected any guarantees. It might be nice to get back to the Strike Force and live a normal life for a change. Or as normal a life a cyborg can hope for, anyway.
Jennifer smiled. Higgins predicted you'd react that way.
Did he? Steele said. Well, I'll have a few things to say to him before we call it quits. But before I leave here, you're going to give me back what you took from me. You had no right to do that, Doctor. No right. No goddamn right at all. I may have lost my family, but I'll be damned if I let you take my memories.
You'll have them back, if that's what you really want. But you should be aware that they're pretty traumatic memories. Think it over. You have an opportunity to start with a clean slate and perhaps...
Out of the question!
Very well. It's up to you. But before we run the program, we should spend some time working out the ghost personality fragments in your matrix. This may be the last chance to debug those glitches, but we'll require more information from you. We can't do it without knowing more about what we're looking for. We need your help.
Forget it!
You don't understand, she said. We need to...
No, Dr. Stone! You don't understand!
Snapped Steele.
I'll spell it out for you. I want you to put back everything that you took out. Everything you got me. And if I find out you held anything back, I'll go straight to the media and raise a stink like you won't believe. I've had it with being your cybernetic guinea pig. You give me back my memories, Doctor, and then stay the hell out of my brain.
She just took a deep breath and let it out slowly. All right, Steele, have it your way. But the decision isn't mine to make alone. I simply don't have the authority. I'll have to take it up with Higgins.
You do that, Steele said. You tell him to get his ass down here and get that ball rolling. Otherwise, you're going to see another cyborg run amok. You got that?
You made yourself quite clear, she said. I'm sorry you're taking it this way. Frankly, I think you're making a serious mistake. Instability in your engram matrix could result in schizophrenia. At least let us try to...
You're wasting your time, Doctor!
As you wish. She got up and went to the door. She opened it, then paused briefly. This could be your last chance. Don't say I didn't warn you. Sergeant Tracy was on his way to the guard mount that would relieve the current watch. He wasn't looking forward to it. He had stood guard duty many times in his career, more times than he could count. And it was not one of those things that improved with age. It was a lonely job, and these days, one that could often be dangerous, especially at night. At Warren, it consisted of walking a section of the base perimeter that was both fenced and protected by large coils of barbed wire. Like a concentration camp, he thought. They had opened up several more silos and two more LCFs. More cocked and loaded guns, more corpses. It was grim, nerve-wracking work. And then the maintenance crews went in ostensibly to verify the status of missiles prior to dismantling them. Ostensibly. Tracy no longer believed that fiction. Pat Summers no longer believed it, nor, he was sure, did many of the other soldiers at the base. But no one talked about it. Whatever suspicions they had, they kept them to themselves. Morale was low. There was a palpable tension in the air. But no one said anything about it. It was as if they didn't want to know. After eating dinner, Tracy had gone back to his quarters and put on his battle dress for guard duty. Beneath his porous and infrared absorbent outer suit, he wore a lightweight two-piece undersuit with gloves and socks, all with integral zoned electrical heating controlled by the computer in his backpack. He wore high boots with armored soles and flexible armored uppers. His full-coverage, dark-visored helmet incorporated a radio, a gyro-stabilized laser designator, a thermal imaging camera, and an image intensifier, with a visor screen for the projection of data from his video systems, as well as computer graphics and aiming marks for his weapons. He carried a double-barreled polymer ceramic battle rifle. The upper barrel was capable of firing high-explosive shells or shaped charges, smoke-emitting or illuminating shells. The lower barrel fired 4.7mm caseless ammunition with a select-fire system capability that offered three-round burst, fully automatic or semi-automatic fire. It could be fired manually using the laser sighting system, but it was also tied into his helmet and slaved to the targeting system in his backpack computer, which was capable of taking voice input commands. His weapon systems was completed by two rocket launchers, one rocket tube on either side of his backpack, capable of firing short-range missiles launched by voice command. He also carried a holstered polymer ceramic 9mm semi-auto on his belt, along with magazine and shell pouches, and a commando Bowie in a self-sharpening sheath. General Cord had given orders that this was to be the uniform for standing guard. He wanted the people under his command to be ready for anything. What, thought Tracy, did he expect? Surely no band of outlaw raiders would be crazy enough to attack a military base. He was halfway to guard mounts, carrying his battle rifle in one hand and his helmet under his arm, when a man burst out from between two buildings on his left. He almost ran right into him. The man froze, then glanced quickly over his shoulder. He wasn't in uniform. He wore rumpled civilian clothes. His hair was disheveled, his trousers were torn, and he looked terrified. Help me, please! For God's sake, you gotta help me! I've gotta get out of here! He's crazy! He's...
You, wait a minute.
Tracy said.
Calm down. What are you talking about? Who are you?
My name is Franks, Dr. Stephen Franks. Please, soldier, you've gotta help me! Someone's gotta warn them! You don't know what he's planning. He's insane! He's totally insane!
Who?
General Cord! He's planning to take over the government. They won't let him do as he says. He intends to launch the missiles. He's gonna take New York!
What?
All right, hold it right there. Freeze!
Oh God, it's too late! Tracy looked up to see three Cobras in their dark green, black-trimmed uniforms and black berets moving in on them, the rifles ready.
You've got to warn them.
Franks whispered frantically. Please, I'm begging you!
Put the piece down!
Wait a minute!
Tracy shouted.
Take it easy!
Put the piece down!
I'm Sergeant Tracy. I was on my way to...
Put it down right now!
Tracy slowly bent down and put the rifle on the ground, then the helmet.
Now stand away from him! Hands straight out of your sides!
Jesus! What is it with you guys? Will you for Christ's sake—
Move!
Tracy complied.
All right now, Dr. Franks! Come along quietly now! Don't make it hard on yourself!
Franks gave him a pleading look, then his shoulders slumped and he turned to walk back toward the men. Two of them fell in beside him and escorted him back to the house where the civilian scientists were quartered. The third approached Tracy, his rifle held waist high, pointed straight at him.
Hey, come on,
said Tracy.
Lighten up for God's sake. What's all this about?
Tracy, huh?
The Cobra was a lieutenant. His name tag on his breast read Morris. He nodded and lowered the gun.
I know you. I've seen you around. What did Franks tell you?
Franks? Was that his name? Jeez, I didn't know,
said Tracy, lying and trying to look confused.
He was babbling something about getting out of here. He was acting crazy. What the hell's going on?
That was all he said.
I don't know what the hell he was yammering about. He kept saying, I've got to get out of here, or something like that. I was on my way to guard mount, and he practically ran into me. What was he, drunk?
Nervous breakdown,
said Morris.
Jesus,
Tracy said, not buying a word of it.
Yeah, he went out a window on the second floor and just took off. Pressure must have got to him.
Poor bastard,
Tracy said.
Christ, he scared the hell out of me, running out like that. And then you guys came along and... Shit, for a minute there, I thought you were going to shoot me.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that. We had a word there with some heavily armed raiders nosing about Cheyenne. Nothing confirmed, but everything's a little edgy.
Bullshit, Tracy thought, but he tried not to allow his disbelief to show.
Christ, the way he came running out of that, I thought I might have shot him. Jesus, I guess my nerves are a little on edge too. You wouldn't have a smoke, would you?
Sure.
Lieutenant Morris pulled a pack out of his pocket and handed it to Tracy. He seemed a little more relaxed now.
What the hell made him freak out like that?
Asked Tracy, anxious to keep the man from thinking that Franks had told him anything. Morris shrugged.
Who knows? These damn birds got everybody nervous. Who knows if they'll blow up or... Not if we crack them open. You're one of the guys on entry detail, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, then you know what I mean.
Tell me about it. We opened two LCFs the other day. Christ, you should have seen the bodies.
Not a pretty sight, huh?
Not hardly. They keep telling us it's safe down there. But like you said, who really knows? Half the guys are going in and... sick call every day. They keep thinking they're coming down with something. Let me tell you, I'll be awful glad when this is over.
Yeah, well, you can guess how the civilians must be feeling, said Morris. They're not used to any of this. They came out here from back east, where all their shit is just so much data on paper. And now all of a sudden, they're looking at the real thing. That's why we're keeping them segregated from the rest of the base personnel. They've got enough to deal with without hearing all the horror stories from the crews opening up the LCFs.
Yeah, I hear you,
said Tracy.
Listen, you think he's going to be all right, Franks, or what's his name?
Yeah, well, one of the shrinks will come in and see him. Give him something to calm him down. Like a little rest will probably be okay. Otherwise, we'll have to ship him home.
Yeah, you figure if someone start running around and screaming, they might ship me home too?
Morris chuckled. I wouldn't count on it.
Yeah, well, it was an idea. Look, I've got to get going or they'll put me on report.
Okay, take it slow and watch yourself. That rumor about the Raiders might be nothing, but you never know.
Right. I'll keep my eyes open.
Do that. And listen, about what happened here, keep it to yourself, okay? We don't want this getting around. It'd be bad for morale.
Yeah, I see your point.
Make sure you do. If I hear any scuttlebutt about this, I'll know where it came from.
Hey, man, I didn't see nothing.
Good man. Stay loose.
Right. Thanks for the smoke.
Don't mention it.
Tracy made it to the guard mount with seconds to spare. They marched out to relieve the watch, and his stomach was churning all the while. They got to his post, and he went out to relieve the guard, then started slowly walking his post as the guard detail moved away. His brain was full of white noise. Maybe Morris had been right. Maybe Franks really had freaked out and had a nervous breakdown. But he didn't really believe it. He wanted to desperately, but he couldn't get the sight of that scientist's face out of his mind. That face was etched in fear and desperation, and he knew with a sinking feeling that Franks had been telling him the truth. He knew it because it all suddenly made sense. Everything simply clicked together. Why there were maintenance crews in all the silos. Why they hadn't dismantled a single missile. Why they hadn't touched anything in any of the LCCs. Why the civilian scientists were kept segregated from the rest of the base personnel under constant guard. And why the Cobras accompanied every detail into every silo in LCF.
Jesus Christ almighty,
thought.
Court's playing a military coup, and right here at war, and he's got everything he needs to pull it off. What did they question Franks, and he broke down and told them what he said to them? Jesus, I'm scared. I'm really scared.
He intends to launch the missile.
That's crazy. That's really fucking crazy.
He's insane. He's totally insane.
What the hell can I do?
Someone's got to warn them.
What do I call? What do I say? They'll think I'm crazy. How can I make them believe me? What if they got the phones tapped?
Yeah, bothers me.
Pat Summers had said.
But what difference does that make? I don't see what we can do about it.
What if I'm wrong about this?
You're not wrong,
said a little voice at the back of his mind.
You're not wrong and you know it. It fits. It all fits. It's just the sort of thing the Cord would do. Take charge. Institute martial law. Set himself up as a military dictator with his troops and the missiles to back him. Everybody knew he was disgusted with the bureaucrats back east who could never seem to get anything accomplished. Half the time, they couldn't even meet the payroll. They'll back him,
Tracy thought.
They'll all back him. Every goddamn military unit in the country. The man's a born leader. Maybe he's even the right man for the job. Who was he to say? Who was he to decide? His job was to obey his orders, not to question them. But what if they didn't listen? What if they called his bluff? He wouldn't really launch the birds, would he? Yeah, he would. Gordon never backed down from anyone or anything. And with so much at stake, he wasn't about to start now.
Tracy's mouth was dry. It was starting to get dark, and he was all alone out here. Alone, right on the base perimeter. How long would it be before they discovered he was missing?
They'll hunt me down,
thought Tracy.
They'll send out the SPs, and they'll hunt me down. I'd never have a chance.
If he could get to Cheyenne and steal a car, maybe an hour and a half or so to Denver, less if he kept it floored, he just might make it. They'd look for him at Cheyenne first. If he could get to Denver, he could lose himself.
If they catch you, you'll be shot, you dumb fuck. I've got no proof,
he thought.
No proof at all. They'll never believe me. They'll think I'm crazy. Why me? Why does it always have to come down to me? Franks talks,
the little voice said.
You've had it anyway. How long? How long have I got? Morris didn't seem to suspect. Maybe Franks won't talk. Maybe he won't say anything. Go,
said the little voice.
Go now while you've still got the chance. Christ. Oh, Christ.
He tossed his rifle up over the fence.
Okay,
he thought.
Now you've done it. No turning back now.
He started to scale the fence. Higgins wasn't sure why he felt compelled to do the thing in person. It wasn't as if the man was his friend. In fact, he wasn't sure what the precise nature of their relationship was. Technically, Ice was an employee of sorts, an agent in a sense. Only there were no other agents in the CIA quite like him. In the old days, Higgins had imagined that the company, as they had called it back then, had employed a lot of men like Ice. Back when the CIA was like some vast octopus with more tentacles than they can count, the section chiefs had virtually complete autonomy and a free hand to recruit whatever personnel they felt they needed, without ever having to document them on paper. They had informers on their payroll, criminals, assassins, hookers, politicians, businessmen, all field agents who reported to their section chiefs directly and were paid out of the section's budget, which in those days had been allotted without a lot of questions being asked about itemization and expenditures. It must have been really something back then, thought Higgins. At one time, or so the story went, a new incoming CIA director had requested a complete file on all the personnel working for the agency. He had been told that the request was impossible to grant because nobody really knew. They had absolutely no way of knowing. Back then, the agency had been so large and its structure so incredibly intricate that trying to conduct a census of all its personnel would probably have been impossible. There were departments within departments within departments, sections within sections within sections. Section chiefs had field agents they employed that no one knew about except themselves, and in order to guarantee the security of those agents, it was a policy that their identities were never to be revealed to anybody else. Unless special arrangements had been made, new incoming section chiefs did not inherit their predecessors' contacts, but recruited their own people, and those people had their own people, whom they paid off with their section's budget. Boxes within boxes within boxes. The CIA had eyes and ears everywhere. Now the agency was little more than a tiny bureaucratic arm of a crippled federal government that was fighting for survival. A mere handful of agents and office staff. And soon, it would cease to even be that. Higgins wondered how much time he had left before that bastard Carmen brought the axe down. A month? A week? Perhaps only a matter of days or even hours. And then what? If he had been an ass-kisser, a brown-noser like Harding, there would have been no problem getting reassigned to some nice, cushy post in some other government department. But hey, wasn't anything like Harding, and besides, he didn't want that. He was not a bureaucrat at heart. Jennifer touched a chord within him, and it was vibrating like a tuning fork. The no man's land out there is really something. It's big. It's wild. You could be young again. Could he? Indeed? Perhaps. The only time in his life that he had truly felt alive was when he had been with the Special Operations Group. God, those have really been the days. He felt a purpose then, a vibrancy, a sense of significance and import they had never truly been able to recapture. Project Download had provided him with a sense that he was doing something, taking part in something important. With Steel, he had once again begun to feel that he was making a contribution that would help bring the country back together, get it back on the road to becoming the nation it once was. But still, for all the sense of accomplishment the project gave him, it was not the same. It never could have been. Not behind a desk. Jennifer understood that. She had understood him better than any woman he had ever known. Better than anyone he had ever known, except perhaps one man. He wondered what Zack Cord was doing now. Last he heard, they had given him command of the entire Northwest Sector. A few isolated towns and settlements and miles of desolate wilderness, interspersed with bombed-out hotspots. Cord was probably loving every minute of it. He was in his element. He could have had the job that Higgins had wound up with, but he turned it down.
The only thing you can accomplish from behind a desk is to give yourself hemorrhoids and lower back pain,
Cord had said contemptuously when he had chosen the option of being transferred to the regular service.
If you're smart, Skeet, then you'll stick with me. We'll make our own damn opportunities. We'll find a way to fight it our way, like we always did.
Cord had given him the nickname Skeet, because as a younger man, Higgins had been thin as a rake and wiry. One time, Cord and his squad had been pinned down by raiders who had laid down a withering fire with automatic weapons, immobilizing them. Higgins and his squad had pulled him out of it, repeatedly flanking the numerically superior enemy and using hit-and-run guerrilla tactics, making them think they were up against a much larger force. Later, Cord had compared him to a pesky Skeeter. No matter how many times they slapped at him, Higgins merely darted away and kept on stinging. And the name had stuck. No one called him Skeet in years, and he hadn't spoken to Zack Cord since the breakup of the SOG. When they had gone their separate ways, Cord to the army and Higgins to a bureaucratic post at agency headquarters in New York. He had been ambitious then, anxious to move up, but that had been before he found out how stultifying a bureaucrat's life could be. But by the time he learned that, he had already become accustomed to a lifestyle that involved a luxurious apartment, custom-tailored clothes, fine wine and whiskey, and meals in the best restaurants in town. He enjoyed the company of beautiful women, and he had a position of respect and responsibility with a salary that was commensurate with his post. And yet, as the years rolled inexorably by, he came to miss the old days more and more. Now it seemed to him that Cord had made the best decision. He was still out there, a general in the forefront of the action, commanding his famous Cobra Force, while Higgins had followed victim to politics. He was out of a job, because he hadn't bothered playing kissy face with Carmen's ample cheeks. There would be no other government post that would enable him to continue to support his lifestyle. Yet,
Somehow, that didn't seem so terribly important anymore. He kept thinking about what Jennifer had said about New Mexico. Could he really start all over again? A man with his background, with his credentials? Probably have no trouble getting a post with some police force or paramilitary security outfit. But it had been a long time since he had taken orders. He was much more used to giving them. Perhaps he could set up some sort of independent outfit out of his own. He was certainly qualified, and there would be no lack of work. Not out there. The question was, did he really want to go out there? Jennifer? He never really had a serious relationship, and incredible though it seemed, she had never had any sort of relationship at all prior to meeting him. What she had said was certainly true. They were both very independent and aggressive personalities. It required a lot of space. They did respect that in each other. But that was here, where they both had separate places to live, though they'd been spending almost all of their nights together. And they both had demanding and fulfilling jobs. If she were transferred back to Los Alamos, she'd still have her work, but he'd be starting out from scratch. That could put a lot of pressure on their relationship. And despite the strong attraction that they felt for one another, they hadn't really known each other for very long. And he still had a lot of doubts. He needed time to think about it. Only, he wasn't sure how much time he had. Perhaps that was why he felt like he had to make this call in person, because this was another man who'd have the rug yanked out from under him. And though they couldn't be more different in certain very elemental ways, they were a lot alike. Both fighters. Men who preferred to tackle life on their own terms, but who could take anything in life handed out, with no complaints and no regrets. Maybe they weren't exactly friends. Maybe they didn't even like each other very much. But they understood and respected one another. And that was no small thing. The man who opened the door was huge. He was black, well over 6 feet tall, with a chest that stretched the tape at 60 inches, and arms that measured 24 around the biceps. His flaring lats gave him a dramatic V shape as they tapered down to a narrow, muscular waist. His head was shaved, and he usually wore dark sunglasses. However, on this rare occasion, Higgins could see his eyes. And Ice looked even meaner with the shades off.
"Well, well, this be a surprise,"
he said in a remarkably deep voice that sounded like the crack of doom.
"Mr. H, to what I owe the pleasure of this visit."
"Hello, Ice. Mind if I come in?"
"Mi casa, su casa,"
Ice said, stepping aside.
"Might as well be. You paying for it."
"Yes, well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about."
"Have a seat,"
said Ice.
"Drink?"
"No, thanks. I won't be long." He sat down on the couch. Ice settled his giant frame in a chair across from him. As usual, he was dressed all in black, with a minimal amount of jewelry. Just a heavy gold ring and a gold chain around his neck, a small gold skull dangling from it, a keepsake from his days as a leader of the Skulls. The apartment was fairly Spartan. Just a couch, two large and comfortable lounge chairs, a lamp, a coffee table, and a television set. The dining room had a table and four chairs. The kitchen had a smaller table, some chairs, and a refrigerator. The bedroom had a large queen-size bed, two nightstands, and a bureau. All were furnishings that had come with the place. Ice had done absolutely nothing to make it his own. The walls were bare. The place had sort of a bleakness about it. And yet, unless he was on a job for the agency, which usually meant working with steel, he did not go out much. Apparently, he did a lot of reading, although he didn't keep the books. He either borrowed them or brought them, or bought them and then sold them, as soon as he had read them. His taste surprisingly ran to the classics, which really didn't jibe with his style of street talk and his hard case image. Clearly, there was a lot more to him than met the eye. Though Higgins had never been able to penetrate the cold and implacable exterior that Ice presented to the world. It was like trying to know a statue. By the time they had met, there had been a contract out on Ice. For years, he had been a wanted criminal, the leader of the most powerful street gang in the No Man's Land, just north of Midtown, the area known as Harlem. Nothing at all was known about his background, and Ice didn't volunteer any information. No one even knew his real name. Under his leadership, the Skulls had become a powerful force in No Man's Land, either subjugating or driving out most of the competing gangs. But when crime boss Victor Borodini made his bid to bring the street gangs under his control, Ice had resisted. Borodini closed a deal with a younger faction of the Skulls, and Ice wound up squeezed out and on the run, and with a large contract on his life. And it was then that Ice approached the federal authorities with an offer to help them nail Borodini and neutralize his operations. A meeting was set up in an abandoned storefront out in No Man's Land, and the man sent out to negotiate with the former leader of the Skulls had been Donovan Steele. But Ice had been betrayed, and Borodini's soldiers hit the storefront moments after Steele had arrived. Ice managed to escape, but Steel was shot down and left for dead. It was the event which led to his being reconstructed as a cyborg. Shortly thereafter, Ice came in and out of the cold and met with Higgins. In exchange for his cooperation with the authorities, he was given amnesty and placed on the agency's payroll. Together, Ice and Steel had dismantled Victor Borodini's operations in the city and taken down his heavily protected enclave out in Cold Spring Harbor. First, Higgins had his doubts about him, but the big man had played straight with him right from the beginning. Now Higgins figured that the least he could do was return the favor. "I'm afraid I've got bad news," he said, "and I wanted to let you know in person." After what happened with Stalker, the committee decided to cut our funding. We're being shut down. They're taking Download away from the agency, and the Cyborg project is being scrapped. They don't want any reputation of what happened with Stalker. At least, that's the excuse they're using. What it all comes down to is that without Download and with the Cyborg project shut down, the agency is no longer doing anything that can't be handled by the military or by other government departments. So it looks like we're going to be disbanded.
"I see,"
said Ice.
"So I'd be out of work, huh?"
"Yeah," Higgins nodded. "Most of the other agency personnel will probably be transferred to other departments, but your case is somewhat special. Given your background, I don't see them being too anxious to find another slot for you. I don't really know what I can do, but I'll try to pull some strings to get you a job with a security branch somewhere, or maybe give you a recommendation to Strikeforce. I'm not completely without influence." And I just gave a short, barking laugh.
"Me? A policeman? I don't think Chief Hardesty would be too happy about that. I look damn silly in a uniform. No, I think I pass."
"Well, I'm not sure what else I can do for you," Higgins said. "And I'd like to be able to do something. I owe you at least that much."
"You don't owe me nothing, Mr. H. We had us a deal. I help you, you give me a crack at Victor Borodini. You done that. We square."
"You'll have to give up this apartment," Higgins said. "They'll be asking you to leave soon. Where will you go?"
"I come up with something. Always have."
"I'm sorry about this, Ice. They're cutting me loose, too. I've made too many enemies. But while I'm still in office, is there anything that I can do for you? Anything at all?" I shook his head.
Don't worry about me, Mr. H. I take care of myself. This straight life's not really my scene, anyway. But I appreciate the offer. What are you gonna do?"
"I don't know yet," Higgins said. "I may be heading out west to New Mexico. See if I can remember what it's like to get my hands dirty." He paused. "Look, why don't you consider coming with me? I'm probably going to put together some kind of private outfit on my own out there. I could use a good man like you."
"Well, that's mighty white of you,"
said Ice with a big smile.
"But I'm a city boy. I done grew up here. I think I stick around. Maybe I put together something of my own, too."
"What, another gang?"
"Why not? Maybe I look in the skulls again. I hear they're not doing so well since I left."
Higgins shook his head. "That would be a waste, Ice. What kind of life is that? You can do better for yourself. Look, it's your life. I'm not going to try to tell you what to do. You've always played straight with me, and I appreciate that. You helped us take Borodini down, and I'd like to return the favor. At least think about what I said, okay? I'll keep the offer open." Ice nodded.
"I'd do that. What about Steel?"
"I don't know. I suppose he'll probably wind up back with the Strike Force. If you go back to No Man's Land, it'll put you two on opposite sides. I'd really hate to see that happen." Ice pursed his lips thoughtfully and nodded.
"Yeah, that'd be too bad."
"Well, look, I've said my piece. Give it some thought. You've done some real good, Ice. I'd hate to see you throw it all away by going back to the wrong side of the law."
"Law didn't do all that much for you, did it?"
"It wasn't the law that did me in," said Higgins, thinking of Carmen. "It was the lawyers. There's a big difference."
"So you're going to be coming back?"
"Yes, we'll be releasing him before too long. I've got to go back and see him. I expect he'll have a thing or two to say to me."
"Ask him to stop by,"
said Ice. "I'll do that." He got up and Ice walked him to the door. Higgins paused. "Look, just in case we don't ever see each other again, well, I'd like to wish you luck."
"You too, Mr. H,"
he smiled.
"For a Fed, You not so bad.
Higgins smiled and offered him his hand. They shook. Take care of yourself. As he walked down the hall toward the elevator, he wondered if he'd ever see the big man again. It was strange. They came from completely different backgrounds, and he had almost nothing in common. And in the old days, back when he'd still been with Cord and SOG, they'd have been deadly enemies. Yet in a funny sort of way, he was going to miss him. End of chapter.